Call to order this meeting of the House Rules Committee. It is Wednesday, April 13th, 2011. Welcome, everybody. I think we are actually going to go in order of what is on our agenda, which would be unusual for us. We may have a couple of members who are sponsors, at least of the last two bills, that if they come in, we may need to pull those last two up, but they will be very short of that if that occurs. First of all, colleagues, you've got in front of you four LC drafts that are for possible introduction of committee members. LC 4000, 4100, 4101, and 4102. Well, Mr. Stenberg, do you want to give a summary of these?
Yes,
four?
This is legislative draft 4000. It is a bill that would be the companion piece for H.J.R. 40, Representative Garrett's measure that would amend the Constitution. I don't know if you want more information on each of these or not. LC 4100 is a legislative draft that would be a House resolution commemorating the Oregon wine industry pioneer Richard Sommer. LC 4101 is a legislative draft that would be a joint memorial to urge the United States Department of Veterans Affairs to establish full level 2 hospital in Roseburg, Oregon. And LC 4102 is a legislative draft that would be a concurrent resolution commemorating the City of Sutherland on the occasion of its centennial.
The City of Sutherland was feeling jealous of Gladstone and Eagle Point. So as the good representative from West Salem has reminded us, introduction of these measures signals neither assent nor opposition to these measures. Do we have a motion to introduce these?
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 4000, 4100, 4101, and 4102 forward to committee bills.
And can you just go ahead and add the dates on each of those to them? That'd be great.
Affirmative, Mr. Chair. Okay, 4000 is dated 4-8-11. 4100 is dated 4-11-11. 4101 is 4-8-11, and 4102 is 4-11-11.
So, Co-Chair Olson moves the introduction as committee members of LC 4000, 4100, 4101, and 4102 with the dates he listed as committee measures. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Those are all the committee measures we have, right, Mr. Stenberg?
That's correct.
Okay. So the first item up on our agenda is a public hearing, which I will open on House Bill 2442. Mr. Stenberg.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2442 prohibits the use of the word independent in the name of a political party.
Thank you. We have, I believe, just two folks signed up to testify, Marvin Sands and Linda Williams. If you would both come forward. Marvin and Linda. Go ahead, Marvin. You can begin. She's making her way over, if you would.
I'm Marvin Sanis.
So if you could pull that mic closer to you.
Okay.
Thanks. Great.
I ran last fall as a Republican nominee in the election. I was also the independent nominee. And I'm new to politics. It was my first time at this. And one of the things I learned, which was a disappointment to me, were how few young people are attracted to this, to government. You look around this room, and I don't see anybody under 30 in here.
Easy.
I'm sorry if I insult somebody. But lots of young people I talked to said that they were attracted to the independent party. Now, maybe it was the name, maybe it said it's not affiliated. But anyway, when I read that this, that the legislature was proposing to, it made me gulp. what the heck is, why? Anyway, and also the vote by internet. I thought that was an exciting experiment. House District 21, and I can't remember the numbers, but I won that nomination. I think I had 12 or 14 for me, and Representative Clem had 9, I think, 8 or 10, something like that. And none of the above were about 4 votes. But I thought it was a very interesting experiment. So anyway, I'd hate to see the legislature discourage them in this session. They attract young people, and that's what we need to do. That's one of the things that you people need to do is open this thing up and make it attractive to young people. That's all I wanted to say. I'm against this 2442. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Speaking for the Under 30 Caucus, Linda.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, and members of the committee. I am Linda Williams. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm speaking in opposition to 2442, which will probably not surprise anybody. I was the sponsor of the 2006 petition to form the Independent Party of Oregon. I've fairly lengthy exhibits which have been distributed that show that at all times the Independent Party has identified itself as a political party from the first petition through many steps that we've taken. And again, Mr. Sanis was good enough to mention the internet vote, where we actually mailed postcards to everyone, individual postcards, people's names on them, to 55,000 people who were registered with the Independent Party as of June. Was very clear, Independent Party election, you're a member. After the election period began, many candidates, including Mr. Sanis, but including John Kitzhaber, who eventually was successful, any number of other folks from the congressional races, Senator Devlin, many representatives, sent tens of thousands of additional pieces of mail to people saying, you're a member of the Independent Party. So I'm a little skeptical of people who tell me that it's confusing. And that's really all I've heard is this kind of underground buzz. It's very confusing to voters. We did everything within our limited means to inform people. It's a political party. You're a member. Exercise your right to vote. The state has also gone out of its way to vigilantly prepare the voter registration cards in a manner that identifies you're a member, not a member of a party. In fact, I think that they have changed the cards so now the first choice anyone sees will be, I'm not a member of a party. There are many other steps. For example, the voter's pamphlet for the first time carried a footer with all the party names. Those persons, of course, who were cross-nominated or who were nominees of political parties, it appears in fairly large type in the voter's pamphlet. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps close to all 2 million voters, see these evidence of the fact that there is an independent party in Oregon. So I was going to discuss that within my 3 minutes. I was also going to give you some legal argument. I will now leave that to the testimony of Steve Goldberg, the attorney who successfully challenged ORS 248010, a statute which was used to try to prevent the Freedom Socialist Party from forming in Oregon because another party was using one of those words. The Oregon Court of Appeals found that to be unconstitutional under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, and Judge Landau, who's now, of course, Justice Landau on the Supreme Court, wrote a very strong piece saying, in his opinion, it was also unconstitutional under the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, which I'm sure you're all familiar with and which we hold very dear and special here in Oregon. So I decided not to do those things because it occurred to me that your hearing today really, we've not been presented with the information of what the opponents what the people who want to change the word and outlaw the word independent, which has had a proud use in Oregon. There's been the Independent Initiative Party. There was a branch of the American Independent Party. Somehow people were able 10 or 20 or 50 years ago to deal with that word independent, and no one thought it was terribly confusing. So I find it difficult to prepare adequate testimony to address what may be legitimate concerns, maybe you've heard them from folks, when there's no sponsor for the bill. The opposition has mainly been in the blogs of partisan operatives of the major political parties. It's kind of like having a trial convened by ambush. You have unknown accusers. You can't really respond with facts and good information. So luckily, we asked our members to respond over the weekend, and others who will testify will tell you what some of our members think, and we have hundreds of responses of people and are now starting to get editorial support for our belief that we have both a freedom of speech and freedom of assembly right to choose our name, and our members have the right to participate in those civic responsibilities and liberty. And I would also mention that we've invested quite a lot of energy and time, as some of these documents will show, and we believe that we have a vested interest in our name and the continued use of our name, which should be compensable under the Takings Clause of the Oregon Constitution. So thank you for your time, members.
Great. Thank you both. Questions for either of these two witnesses?
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. Do we have anybody that's going to testify that is in favor of this?
I have two additional people, both of whom I believe are testifying in opposition. So unless someone else is here, is there anyone else besides, I just got handed a note with Sal Paralta and Dan Meek. Is there anyone else besides these two, Sal Paralta and Dan Meek, who would like to testify on this bill? Then the answer, Representative.
There's not going to be a proponent who testifies, then I'd like to ask a question.
Do we not have a proponent of the bill?
There is no apparent proponent of the bill signed up to testify.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Do you want to yield to Representative Garrett?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Garrett.
So, Linda, unfortunately, we won't hear from, I guess, the advocates. So I don't know what facts we might be presented with, but I can ask you a hypothetical.
Sure.
The concern to me has just been based on common sense, not any data or evidence, that it strikes me that it's inherently confusing to have a party called the Independent Party. I don't know. I don't have data. I don't know what percentages of people who are members of the party might be unaware that they're members of the party. But what if we learned that 25% of the members of the party were not aware that they were members of the party and intended to be unaffiliated and were simply mistaken? Would you agree that that's a problem, or would you not agree that that's a problem?
Well, I have two responses. One is, as I try to outline, and I'm sure you're aware of this, Representative Garrett, as I said, we mailed very clear postcards to 55,000 people. The candidates themselves sent tens of thousands additional postcards. This was during the month of July. We got perhaps a dozen emails or a couple of letters from folks that didn't have email that said, I'm not a member of the party, I thought I was unaffiliated. A dozen people. Now, maybe other people quietly re-registered after they read newspaper accounts, and there was lots of ink spilled on this on the election. So as a practical matter, as an empirical, factual matter, of the 55,000 people who got cards and notices from numerous candidates, an infinitesimally small fraction said to us, this is a mistake, what do I do? And we then either directed them by email to the voter reg card online, or for I think two or three people didn't have email, I simply mailed them voter registration cards and said, check the box you meant to check. So as an empirical experiment, it's a diminishing a number of people down to zero. So it's hard for me to take a hypothetical, well, maybe it's 50% or 100% or 20%. It didn't happen. Secondly, I'd have to say, I think justice is inherently a nice word that might confuse people if they think there's a justice party, and then it, let's say, takes a stand on the death penalty, and people don't think that's justice. Republican and Democrat, or Democratic Party, are terms that are nice. They have a historical meaning. Libertarian has a historical meaning, yet lots of people who are Republicans think of themselves as libertarians in some sense. So, although you may have a gut reaction that something is inherently confusing to someone else, I don't think that justifies the word police or the thought police. In Oregon, we have a First Amendment right to use that word and to create an identity for that word. And the word, we have striven through our candidate selection process, through the voter pamphlet statements, in every press release and the materials on our website, to give a particular meaning to those terms. What does the Oregon Independent Party mean in the tradition of Wayne Morse and Tom McCall? Probably doesn't mean the same thing to the Independent Party of Hawaii or the New Mexico Independent Party. So the final point I would make, Representative Garrett, is that as confusing or troubling as it may be to someone who's made a mistake, and people make mistakes with forms all the time. Some people probably even filled in their ballot and made mistakes. These things happen when you deal with large numbers of people. No one was injured in any aspect of their civic duties or their civil rights. If someone had intended to be a non-affiliated voter, they would not have gotten a partisan primary ballot in May. They couldn't vote for a Republican or a Democrat. They got the same ballot as everybody else for the ballot measures and for the non-partisan and the local other matters that are on the May ballot. So no one lost an opportunity to vote for a Republican or a Democrat, unless you're saying one of those folks was really confused and signed up as an independent. In the general election, they got exactly the same ballot as everybody else. Everybody did. All minor parties, all independents, all non-affiliated. So the only injury was that someone felt, I made a mistake, and someone was asked to participate in a forum and in a binding online partisan primary. Now, that everyone's right to their political affiliation certainly is near and dear to them, and they have the right to carefully participate in those things or decline to participate as non-affiliated. But I find it difficult to say that it was so confusing that there were large numbers of people who were aghast at what had happened. If you look at the voter registration statistics throughout the summer, there was never a drop-off. There was never a fleeing of hundreds of people, not even dozens of people from the party. There has been a steady and sustained growth during the election year, of course. Everybody, there was much higher statistics. And since the 2010 election, it has averaged out to about 1,000 registrants a month, a little bit more. So maybe those people are the ones you're concerned about, the confused ones.
Representative Garrett, any the rest of your questions? Representative Wingert.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little baffled. I'm new. This is only my second term, but I can't remember being in a committee hearing in which there were no proponents of a bill. I'm trying to figure out how we got to the place that we're having a hearing on a bill that no one came forward to make an argument for.
I think we actually had one in this committee earlier this session, but sometimes the That is unusual.
Representative Berger. Comment. Well, if you have dropped by the Revenue Committee, a lot of our bills nobody wants to see.
No one?
Nobody claims them.
I have one additional point for Representative Garrett. I've seen some, you know, stuff on the partisan blogs and occasionally misstatements that people seem to believe that at some time in the past they could register as independents on the voter registration card. And that's simply not true. That's simply just not true. So when I see something occasionally that says, well, I'm a small I independent and that's what I put on the registration card, conceivably someone could have written in small I independent on the other line, but the Secretary of State and the Director of Elections at the time, John Lindbeck, were very clear in instructing the clerks when the independent party was formed that they were not to count anyone who had previously, for whatever reason, written in the word independent as a registered member of the independent party. So state officers have been aware of potential confusion, and I would suggest they're in a fairly good position to design the voter registration card in such a way that helps educate people, and we think each election process has helped to educate people, and voters are not stupid. They'll come around. They'll understand.
Are there further questions? Co-Chair Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just would like to ask a question of Representative Berger, because you were on the Interim Committee on Rules, and this came from your, I mean, I realize that it has no name or anything. Was there ever any discussion along this line of this? So this just surfaced.
This just surfaced in my mind.
No, and we can't figure out who's owning it.
Nobody came to me and said, we're teeing up this bill.
Okay.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
I called Sal Peralta and Dan Meek.
No idea.
And again, is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill besides Sal and Dan? Okay. Welcome back to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Distinguished chairs, honorable members of the committee, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2442 on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon. I have to say my high dudgeon at this bill is somewhat deflated because if there's no one to argue with, I'm putting forward an argument.
Point.
Easiest debate ever, I suppose. And in fact, this bill is so clearly unconstitutional that I wasn't sure how seriously to take it. One of our members actually thought it was a prank. Maybe it was. I like the tack that the Albany Democrat Herald took in today's editorial opposing this bill, that the sponsors, or I guess we can say non-sponsors, of this little bit of nonsense have gone to the Alice in Wonderland Institute of Politics, where they teach you to change reality by changing what things are called. Or perhaps they learned how to neutralize opponents at the Joe Stalin Graduate School of Political Maneuvering. Don't like what a party does? Just ban its name. But when a legislator, or a group of legislators, or in this case, no legislators at all, hold a proverbial gun to your head and tell you to do something, in this case, change your name or die, you kind of have to take it seriously. At least we do. So we've received written testimony in opposition to this bill from former Secretaries of State Norma Paulus and Phil Kiesling. I quote in part from their testimony, "We're aware of no legal precedent in any jurisdiction of the United States that would allow a legislature to ban the use of a word in a name of a political party, and are highly skeptical that the Oregon Constitution, with its broad protections for free speech, would permit such an intrusion on the association and speech rights of a duly constituted political party. Pass this bill, or even treat it semi-seriously, and what's next? Bills to ban the word Republican or Democratic from other parties because one party in power feels threatened? This bill is cynical, political mischief at its worst, most juvenile kind, worthy of being thrown down on the legislative scrap heap so this body can get down to the important business at hand." That was the Secretaries of State, not me, saying that. We've also received written testimony from Stephen Goldberg, a Portland attorney who in 2002 litigated the case Freedom Socialist Party v. Bradbury, which struck down a similar unconstitutional Oregon law that banned the use of a word by a political party if that word was also in use by another political party. Mr. Goldberg notes, "It seems to me, in light of the Freedom Socialist Party decision, that HB 2442 is an even more egregious infringement on the independent party's federal and state constitutional rights, as discussed in the Oregon Court of Appeals. I understand that HB 2442 is premised on the need to prevent widespread voter confusion. That rationale was also relied on by the state to justify ORS 248.010 and was rejected by the majority opinion and by Judge, now Justice Landau's concurring opinion. I now quote in part from Judge Landau's concurring opinion in the Freedom Socialist case. Article 1, Section 8 provides that no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restraining the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. Under State v. Robertson and its progeny, a law that restrains speech based on the content of that speech is unconstitutional unless the restraint is wholly contained within a historical exception. In this case, it strikes me that the statute runs headlong into the free expression guarantee of Article 1, Section 8. A political party name communicates a message to voters. Its name, in fact, is a shorthand expression for a core value that the party wishes to communicate to the public. It certainly is speech, and a regulation that prohibits a party from using certain words to express that message certainly is a regulation based on the content of speech. The parties have identified no historical exception that wholly contains such a restraint, and I am aware of none. It necessarily follows that the restraint is unconstitutional. So what core value of the independent party does the word independent communicate? Perhaps the most important thing it communicates is that our members are independent of both major political parties. It also communicates that our members are strong, self-reliant, and not subject to the will of others. Much has been made by our opponents that the party's rapid growth is attributable to confusion on the part of our members. I would argue that our party's rapid growth is actually due to the fact that, according to recent polls, 58% of Americans do not feel well represented by either major political party and believe that a third party is needed. I'd like to note for the record that I brought with me a petition signed by 485 Oregonians, most of whom are members of the Independent Party of Oregon, urging you to oppose this legislation. That petition reads, "Attention, Oregon legislators. We, the undersigned, oppose any effort to restrict the free speech and free association rights of the members of the Independent Party of Oregon. We oppose House Bill 2442, which would force the Independent Party of Oregon to change its name by the end of the year or be abolished. We call on the Oregon legislature to spend less time about worrying about how to take away our rights and more time working together to solve the major issues facing the day." Among the members who signed this petition are two recently retired Oregon mayors, two retired state legislators, a half dozen college and university professors, and four attorneys. Suffice to say that none of our members who signed the petition were pleased that at least some of our legislators regard them as too ignorant to correctly fill out a voter registration card.
And Sal, if you could summarize,
yeah,
I
apologize. I realize that the committee is busy, and I'll redact the remainder of my testimony, except to just make a few minor closing points. The Independent Party is not the first Oregon political party to use the word independent in its name. Ross Perot formed the Independent Initiative Party to gain ballot access in 1992. Richard Winger, the author of Ballot Access News and a leading expert on political parties, recently noted that no state has ever passed a law telling a party that was already ballot qualified that it had to change its name. If this bill were passed at a federal level, it would effectively ban eight political parties in the United States that currently use the word independent in all or part of their names, and it would place us on a global list of states that have forcibly disbanded political parties that most recently includes Iran, Myanmar, Thailand, and Gabon, a rogue's list if ever there was one. I'm going to quit with the rest of my testimony, but I do urge the Rules Committee to kill this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan, welcome.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members. My name is Dan Meek. I'm a member of the Independent Party of Oregon. I've provided to the committee and also for the public some copies of three things. One is a press release that the Independent Party put out yesterday. One is a copy of comments from about 40 signers of a petition with basically the same content that Sal Peralta read a second ago, urging the legislature to reject this bill, from persons who are not members of the Independent Party. It's from a different list of members of other minor parties. And finally, a copy on yellow paper of the editorial today from the Albany Democrat Herald by Hassel Herring, with whom I'm sure you're all familiar. I think all the points have pretty much been covered. In response to Representative Garrett's question, I would point out a couple of things. As Linda Williams stated, before the Independent Party was formed, folks could not register on their voter registration cards as independent. You check the box for not a member of a party, or you would check no party box at all. In either case, Those folks were then considered non-affiliated. The term independent wasn't used to describe the voter. When the Independent Party was formed, the Secretary of State revised, eventually, the voter registration form, and I have a copy of that here, and I can provide many copies to the committee. And what you must do in order to join the Independent Party is you must check the oval for Independent Party. There is no choice for independent for that word by itself without the word party. In addition, the Secretary of State instructed the clerks that if anyone filled in or checked the oval for other and then filled in the word independent, that would not be counted as a member of the Independent Party. You would have to check the oval for other and fill in the words independent party in order to join the Independent Party. So it's actually pretty difficult and pretty straightforward process for joining the party through the voter registration card. And as Ms. Williams indicates, that anyone can speculate about how many people are confused about which political party they've joined, and that includes not only the Independent Party but others as well. There's no harm to anyone from joining the Independent Party. There we charge no dues. The only thing that happens is that the person becomes eligible to vote in the Independent Party primary. So they receive an additional privilege, and they are at no cost to them, and they lose no rights whatsoever or privileges whatsoever. As Ms. Williams pointed out, everyone in the party this summer received a voting card with a unique password on it so they could vote in the Independent Party primary. And each of them received multiple pieces of candidate literature, usually those big, those giant postcards, all of which were addressed to and expressly referred to members of, dear members of the Independent Party, please vote for me. And the result of that was virtually zero persons resigning from the Independent Party. So I don't know of any confusion that exists. I don't know of any harm to a member of the Independent Party if they are joined by mistake. We've had on the front page of our website from day one a legend urging folks, if you don't want to be a member of the Independent Party, please click here, go to the electronic voter registration form and join another party or join no party at all. And as Mr. Peralta said, it may appear that this bill has no supporters, but it was scheduled for a hearing, and we take it very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Weir?
Dan, I have a quick question for you. Could someone form the non-affiliated party?
Probably not. And that's because Representative Wingard and the co-chairs. Probably not because the word unaffiliated, or in this case non-affiliated, is used to officially describe someone who is not a member of a party. Independent has not been used to describe in statute someone who is not a member of a party. So he probably couldn't form a party with the name unaffiliated or non-affiliated.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Seeing no one else to testify on that bill, I would close the public hearing on House Bill 2442 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2492.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2492 removes the election of major party precinct committee persons from the primary election.
So let's begin with Tim Scott, Barry Pack, and Mike Eliason. We have a full page of folks to testify on this bill. Although the three of you are the only proponents, so please proceed in whichever order you would like.
First, all right.
Record, please. Welcome back to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-Chairs Hunt and Olson and members of the committee, my name is Tim Scott. I'm the Director of Elections for Multnomah County, here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks in support of House Bill 2492. The Government Efficiency Task Force spent a significant amount of time last year analyzing four areas of government for cost savings and efficiency. The goal stated on their website was to re-examine our system of delivering services with a focus on restructuring government to be more effective and cost-efficient. The aim is to achieve clarification and rationalization of what currently exists. Elections was one of the four areas that they studied. One of the two recommendations in the final report by the task force for elections was the elimination of PCP elections by government. House Bill 2492 is the result of that recommendation, and the clerks feel that PCP elections were a natural choice because of their inefficiency at achieving their goal of electing PCPs. Last May, at the presidential primary in 2010, 17,000 PCP positions were on the primary ballot. 4,000 of those 17,000 positions were filled by election. That left 13,000 vacant positions after the election. On those PCP ballots statewide, clerks tallied 37,000 write-in votes. And those votes had to be hand-tallied because there's no computer system yet that can tally write-in votes. From those 37,000 write-ins, roughly 1,200 people were elected by write-in with the required three votes to get elected by write-in. Of those 1,200 that were elected by write-in, about half accepted the position. Rough math, about 30,000 write-ins were tallied that didn't get anyone elected. Of the 17,000 positions statewide, there were only 25 contested races. 25 precincts where voters actually had to make a choice between the candidates on the ballot for who would get elected and who wouldn't get elected. Clearly, the statistics show that this is not working. Unfortunately, it's the county general fund that bears the cost of these elections. Taxpayers, whether major party members or not, pay for this internal organizational function of the two major parties. The parties do not pay. One recent example of elimination of election processes for cost savings and efficiency was when Beaverton and Forest Grove school districts recently asked voters in their districts whether or not they felt they should continue having local school district committees. At a cost of about $125,000 for Beaverton School District and $19,000 for Forest Grove, the voters said, no, we don't want to have those elections anymore. So despite the Government Efficiency Task Force recommendation, OACC knew it was important to work with the state parties to try to find a solution. Both parties didn't like the idea of elimination, and we heard that. It's too big a step. PCPs are too much a part of what we do. But both parties agreed that there was room for change. With elimination off the table, the goal was to find something that kept the PCP structure intact while still realizing significant efficiency and cost savings. An amendment that has been submitted to Legislative Council, and I believe that came out at about 2 o'clock today, was the result of continuing discussions between OACC and the Democratic Party of Oregon. The amendment, just to give you the highlights, candidates still file for free. Anyone who wants to file can still file as a PCP. Only contested races will go on the ballot, however. That's if more candidates file than there are positions in that precinct to be filled. Non-contested races, where there's an equal or fewer number of candidates, would not go on the ballot. Candidates that miss the filing deadline can still be appointed to vacant positions. There's still plenty of those, and they can go to their local committee meeting and be appointed to those positions. The benefits of this would be fewer races on the ballot. Counties may even be able to place the contested races on the regular ballot as opposed to putting a separate piece of paper in with the envelope as a cost savings. Elimination of tallying frivolous write-ins and write-ins where candidates do not accept the position. Fewer races on the ballot means more timely feedback to the public on results. And with the amendments, the dash ones, we would still see 90% of the cost savings of the whole election statewide. And most of those elections are board pay for hand tallying those write-ins and printing costs reduced. The arguments you're going to hear against this bill are going to talk about vibrant precincts that always have contested races, the need for democratic government-run processes to avoid factions from taking control of local parties. You're going to hear from politicians that got their start by getting three write-ins and thus beginning their career in politics. And you'll hear that somehow this change takes away voter choice. The good news is that under this amendment, there will still be vibrant precincts with contested PCP races on the ballot and a democratic government-run process. Voters with a desire to be a part of their local political party can still file for free, in person, by fax, or even by scanning and emailing their filing form from home. In almost every precinct in the state, this guarantees that they will be elected. And if they miss the filing deadline and still want to be a PCP, they can go to their local party meeting and be appointed to one of the many likely vacant positions in their precinct or an adjacent one. And to the argument that somehow this change removes choice for the voter, if a race is not contested, then is there really a choice being made by the voter? The modification of PCP elections is a simple solution for cost savings and efficiency in elections that has little or no impact on the way major parties do business. It is a change that is consistent with the goals and recommendations of the Government Efficiency Task Force to find more efficient ways for government-run processes. The Oregon Association of County Clerks urges you to support the amendments to modify PCP elections. I just want to say to the amendment, we were thinking that in Section 2, there would be write-ins allowed on the contested races, and it came out of LC with no write-ins on the contested races. And I just wanted to say that Oregon Association of County Clerks supports keeping write-ins on contested races. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. And I'll be very brief. I think Mr. Scott's done a good job of outlining the statistics behind this bill. I'm here to say the Secretary was the chair of the Elections Subcommittee at the Government Efficiency Task Force, which forwarded this recommendation onto the full task force and then was included in its report to the legislature. And the subcommittee was made up of local election folks, state election folks, county clerks, other interested members of the task force, and they were all very strongly in support of removing this function from county election offices as a way to encourage government efficiency and a way to save some costs. So we continue to support eliminating PCP elections as a government-run election entirely. But having said that, we commend the clerks for working with the parties and continuing discussions I hope will continue with both parties around this amendment, and we would support that direction as well.
Mike.
Co-chairs Hunt and Olson, members of the committee. My name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Scott and Mr. Pack have both described the process. Mr. Scott certainly described the details. And I would just say that internally, the Association of Oregon Counties, we've had many discussions about this issue over the last several years. We now have come to a place where we support both the original version of 2492 and the amended version of 2492. We did, the association did take part in the government efficiency task force over the interim. We're at a place right now in county government, much like state government, where we're scrutinizing closely every function of government, every service we provide to see which services, frankly, are not being done efficiently and which are not resulting in the kind of results that we're looking for. This was one that was identified. It's not an incredible amount of money. When you consider the overall scope of county budgets statewide, but it's clear that the process is not working. We do definitely want to continue to work with the parties, and we commend the Democratic Party for the amendments that they've developed. And I just want to say that we do support the bill with the -1 amendment. Thanks.
I realize the dash one just came out this afternoon. You've had just a slight head start on being able to read it than we have. But I have a question about page four. Do you have the dash ones in front of you?
I don't have it.
I have.
Okay. I think Mr. Sandberg is going to bring you a copy. On each of the members of the committee should have the dash ones in front of you. But on page four, where it makes a few tweaks in the language, but as I'm reading the net remaining language on line 7 and 8, it says a major political party shall have a committee person for every 500 electors. I had thought there was some conversation about changing that to 250 electors, but maybe I misunderstood it previously. Could you just speak to that? Is this the right number you intended?
Mr. Chair, I do believe that that was missed by legislative counsel. Just a comment on the removal of each sex in that line. Legislative counsel has determined that that to elect people by gender is unconstitutional, which is why that is being removed. And then so that effectively decreases the representation for the parties by half. So the idea was to try to maintain the same amount of representation by changing it from one for every 500 electors to one to every 250 electors, which would keep representation about the same.
And Barry and Mike, could you just both speak if that's your intent in terms of support for the dash ones?
Co-Chair Hunt, yes, that's correct. We were sort of under the impression that it would go to one in 250, although I guess the parties could sort of decide what is appropriate for them, but we were under the impression that it would be one in 250, and we were supportive of that.
Yeah, and Barry?
Ditto, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll, before I go to questions, let me just say if anyone would like a copy of the dash ones, because obviously the proponents of the bill are asking us to focus on the dash ones, which are a complete replacement for the original bill with the two slight alterations that were noted. If you don't have a copy of the dash ones, you can talk to Amy and she will be happy to give you a copy so we can have our testimony to the greatest degree possible focused around that. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You've commended the Democratic Party for their participation in the work group. Was the Republican Party invited? And if not, why not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the Representative Party was,
it's the Republican Party.
We've
party.
Excuse me, the Republican Party was invited.
I'm used to saying it. That's...
The Republican Party was invited and was a vibrant part of the initial discussions. I believe we had three meetings with the former executive director of the Republican Party and the current executive director of the Democratic Party. Everybody was in the room when we were discussing this, but when there were some personnel changes, we had trouble getting the Republican Party to respond back.
Thank you.
Further questions for these witnesses? Seeing none, thank all three of you. And we'd invite forward Jan Williamson, Greg Leo, and Breda Libby.
Co-Chair Hunt, members of the Rules Committee, my name is Greg Leo. I'm here today for the Oregon Republican Party. We don't have a position on this bill because we haven't really had a chance to review it. I mean, these are brand new amendments. There have been discussions, but the consensus is generally Republicans like the current system, and we're happy to engage in work groups, conversation, whatever, ways to look for government efficiency, but we just are not there at this time on this legislation. So I guess what I would say is the Oregon Republican Party does not support the bill and does not support the dash one amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. and why don't you go ahead? Then we'll have questions for all three. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Janice R. Williamson. I use the R because there's two Janice Williamsons in Salem, Chairman Hunt, Chairman Olson, and members of the committee. This is a personal opinion. I have only been elected a PCP for a few years, but it has been and is still a source of pride for me and my family. Growing up, I never gave politics a thought past who I would vote for president and nothing else. The more endangered this country became, the more involved I have become. One issue about appointed PCPs over elected, the appointed PCPs don't enjoy the same privileges as the appointed ones do. And that's why the elected position is most coveted. I do not like the thought of my position being eliminated or disenfranchised, especially for such a trivial amount of money that's being claimed. $250,000 spread over 36 counties is only $6,944 for each county. Add the fact that the PCPs are only elected every other year makes the cost $3,472 a year. You waste more than that washing cars and watering roadside trees while it's raining. The cost is not even a valid excuse. If this bill goes through, it will create an expensive chain reaction of laws that must be changed in this state, starting with the ORS statutes, both state parties' bylaws, and every county's bylaws, the cost of which has not been considered yet. But in our county alone, which is Marion County, it would cost hundreds of dollars in venue, rent, printing, mailing, time, and travel, plus the trees. I understand you don't get very many reams of paper out of a tree. PCPs are the lifeblood of the party, participating in electing the very officers and legislators of this state. Their well-being needs to be protected and upheld, lest we slip into a government totally appointed like a socialist country. If the government decides not to elect PCPs, what will be eliminated next? PCPs not only determine the state party leadership, they choose the delegates for the national conventions and the electors who vote for our president. This needs to be a free and open process, fully elected by the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Welcome to the Rules Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Great to see you, Representative Hunt, Representative Olson, and the rest of the committees. My name is Breda R. Libby. I'm a PCP in District 406, House District Number 25. 21. Anyway, I'm a second-term PCP. I was appointed, and then I was elected. The thing that I have seen in our particular precinct is we have gone from one PCP to seven PCPs. Maybe Mr. Scott has not noticed this, but we have an electrified amount of people now that want to get involved in the current process, political process. And they are willing to go to the mat by becoming PCPs and stepping out and getting involved in their communities. I walked precincts this last year to try and go against Measure 46 or 66 and 67. I walked for the change that we've had seen come in this state as far as electing more Republicans. I realize that a PCP's job is to be the connection in the neighborhoods for every person. You don't know how many people came to my house and asked me about the things that they thought were important and what the positions were of the different parties. I talked to Democrats, I talked to Republicans. And I think Mr. Scott is missing the point entirely. We have a new group of people out there that want to take and get involved. And I'm sorry that it's a ring on their parade, but the thing of it is, we have to accommodate people. And I'll go back to my notes, I kind of got off subject because of some of the comments that he made. I suppose that you can count me in on the group of growing individuals who believe government and party partisans are trying to cut out the average citizen's ability to participate in our political system. This is a waste of taxpayer dollars to even have this conversation to take and get rid of PCPs. It is also some heavy-handedness coming out of the counties, and also for the facts that the people that are glued to the seats here in Salem. Okay, we have seen the curtains being slowly lowered on the average citizen. With this measure, the curtain will come down even faster. The lack of transparency, the involvement with our government, is already taking a toll on people trying to understand the process of how government works and it makes its decisions. As far as I'm concerned, it is just another veil to be used to make to more cronyism and isolate the citizens from their government. Gentlemen, ma'am, people are getting involved at a bigger percentage. They want to know. They're questioning. We have to question. Our future invariably lies upon each and every citizen getting to have the chance to ask somebody. And if I'm a PCP and I'm sitting in my house and somebody knocks on my door because they know I'm a PCP, I'm going to try and give them as much information, be it it might to some people seem more, biased, but it's usually not. I'm willing to have an open discussion with anybody about any political matters and try and be informed. And I think that Mr. Scott's missing the point. We have a new grassroots amount of people that want to get involved, and to take and cut them off is wrong, just wrong.
Okay.
In an effort, I think, to save some time, I really appreciate you both coming forward, and I know there are other people who want to testify against it, but what it appears we're at a place where the original bill, the intention of ending PCP elections, is off the table. And what is being proposed here is an amendment that would have PCP elections when it's contested, when there are enough people that you actually need to have a contest, and when there's just people who put their name on the ballot, but there's no need because there's not enough. They're not going to lose because they're uncontested or they're running unopposed, or there's two of them and there's only two slots, that they would just be deemed the winner and be issued the certificate so that the clerks do not have to go through the process of holding the election because there's no contest. I think that's something that we could probably fair-minded people could probably get to yes on. And rather than have everybody continue to testify against the original bill, I'm just encouraging everybody to take a look at the Dash 1 amendments and accept that the original bill as envisioned appears as if it is off the table. I'm hoping that might save us some time.
Chair Hunt, Representative Wingard, if I might say thank you. I think that really helps clarify here. We've got a new set of amendments which really are very different than the original bill. I think the Oregon Republican Party needs time to look at it.
Wonderful.
I do want to say that we are in receipt of a April 4th letter from the clerks to talk about a number of elections processes, and we're very happy to engage in a dialogue with the clerks on this.
Great.
I do want to say, though, in the development of the /1 amendments, we were not privy to these amendments until we saw them here today, and so by necessity it will take time for us to read these, digest them, have a dialogue amongst the county chairs, and frankly, before we take a position on any bill, we need, under our bylaws, to review it with the entire State Central Committee.
Great.
So given all that, these I don't think are ready for prime time today. I think there needs to be a lot more public process.
And Mr. Chair, what I'm hearing, we're just having a public hearing today.
Right.
So there's plenty of time to go and have a conversation and let me or other members of the committee know if there are issues with the -1 amendments. But I just would hate us I would prefer us not to continue to take testimony against the bill when it doesn't even appear as if that is on the table anymore. So I think we might be somewhere where we're at least close to a yes and can consider that and work through it, and I would hope that we could do that.
Representative Burr.
If I could comment on Libby's testimony.
Breda.
Breda?
Breda,
yes.
All right, Breda Libby. Sorry, that was close. You are absolutely right. By these numbers, that the number of Republicans filing is way higher than the Democrat filings. And I just want it noted by this data that, you know, it is to be hoped that we get to filling these positions.
Absolutely.
And have to have contested, you know, written. And this bears out your impression that there's a charge here. And in other words, people are charging forward to sign up for these positions on the Republican side. Just wanted it noted.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Chair Hunt, Representative Berger, if I just might say also one step further, the Oregon Republican Party has recently appointed new precinct committee recruitment chairs, and there is a renewed effort to fill every precinct. So this issue is not lost on us. So we appreciate the opportunity to continue dialogue with both the Secretary of State and the county clerks and also the Democratic Party of Oregon.
And I would just say, I mean, especially in light of the testimony that we received earlier, in terms of, I mean, the fact that there was a dialogue going with both parties and then because of a change in leadership,
yeah.
I just don't want to leave the impression that the Republican Party was intentionally left out of the conversation. It sounds like you all chose to absent yourself from the conversation for a season.
It might surprise many in the world outside of, you know, the elections process that we have ongoing dialogue all the time with the Democratic Party of Oregon. And frankly, I think we have very open, frank discussions about areas where we can make the process better and more efficient. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we will continue that dialogue, and we appreciate being included in all the processes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, all three. Appreciate you being here. Invite up our last three witnesses on this, Wayne Brady, Helga Thompson, and Casey Hansen.
You might make people aware that just because they signed up doesn't mean that they have to testify. If they're speaking to the original bill, it might not be necessary.
Yeah, and hopefully you all had a chance. You all have the benefit of being last. You've had an opportunity to look at the Dash 1 amendment, so hopefully your testimony can focus upon that. Wayne.
Chairman Hunt.
Welcome.
Chairman Olson and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Brady. I'm past chairman of the Marion County Republican Party. And this amendment, you know, sounds like a step in the right direction. I do have some questions. What about precincts where there are no filed candidates? Is there going to be any representation in on the ballot or in its insert so a person knows that it's possible to become a PCP? You know, now at least there's an insert in there, and people see that. We get a fair number of people who we were unaware of, who decided, "Gee, I'd like to get involved with the party," and they write in, and without that little slip of paper, we may not ever hear from them. But if we had something in there that at least gave them information on how to contact the party, that would be helpful. So I don't know what the plan is, but.
I just got these amendments too, and the proposed amendments does not address that directly, but that's something that we can put on the table.
Okay, thank you. Now I had a hard time hearing, so I have another question. That was, I couldn't tell for sure if write-ins were allowed in contested races.
The proponents made it clear that although the Dash Ones did not include that, that their intent and commitment, I think, in the Dash Twos would be on page one in line 14, 15, 16, to make it clear that write-ins will be allowed for contested races.
Okay. There's so much here. I just hadn't had a chance to dig through it. So I appreciate it, and we'll further review this. And
okay.
I'll
great.
Get back to you.
Thank you. Helga, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Chairman Hunt, Chairman Olson, and the rest of the committee, my name is Helga Thompson. I'm the chair of the Polk County Republican Party, and I'm here to talk in opposition of the bill, but now that you've changed it, I'm not so opposed. But I do want you to know that PCPs play a vital role, not only as being the voice of the grassroots, but in just the everyday functioning of a group of voters. Just recently in Polk County, we had to fill a commissioner position. And it was a very important position, and it was had to be done under a time frame that was very quick. We were able to do so with the help of the Oregon Republican Party, but each PCP that was there, we had about a 75 to 80% turnout of PCPs for this election, and we were able to do our job with a weighted vote. So each person actually represented a group of in their precinct. It wasn't just one PCP voting. I know Vicki Berger got to represent a whole lot more people than I did. but it is an important thing, and I understand the paperwork that's involved. I've talked to our county clerk about the write-ins, and I do understand that that is a problem for them. But with the new amendment that's coming, I'm not so opposed to what's going on. Thank you.
Casey, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Representative Hunt, Chairman Hunt, Chairman Olson. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Casey Hansen. I'm the chair of the Multnomah County Democratic Party. I originally signed up in opposition to this bill prior to being handed the Legislative Council amendments, which I knew were coming. I just didn't see in front of me. And I'm going to agree with my Republican colleagues. I admire the passion that's been exhibited and their commitment to the process of involving the public. So now that the original is off the table, I'd like to speak directly to the amendments, which I think were really close. I agree with Mr. Brady, and in terms of notification, too. I think one of the primary responsibilities may be to make sure that the voters in the respective parties know that they do indeed have precinct committee people. So I would address that. There is a notification section in this that speaks to online notification, but a piece of paper in the ballot may be helpful as well, so I appreciate you bringing that up. I would also like to commend the county clerks and Director Scott. I know they've put a lot of work into this, and in terms of the cooperation and work with the parties, I think we're very, very close. I do want to call attention to one particular point on page 9 of the amendment. Here, I'll even share with you guys. Right there, it's line 26-27, and it says, at any time a major political party may require that a county central committee reorganize. I think this needs to go back to have some editing on it, because it's not very clear at what that point is and what the kickoff is. It was explained to me outside of the room that was perhaps when either respective party has a non-functional or non-existent county party, and that's not clear in that. So I would request that that language be reviewed. My final point that I'm going to make is not on the table, and I would like to put it on the table. And we throw around the term PCPs glibly because we all know what a PCP is. But in the elevator speech, when you're trying to recruit people to be members of your respective parties, you have to spend 30 seconds to a minute explain what a PCP is after they get done chuckling. I would submit to you that precinct representative or precinct party representative would be a more appropriate title, and we can get to the crux of it quicker. So that would conclude my off-the-cuff testimony for today.
These witnesses. Seeing none, thank all three of you. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Seeing no one else to testify on this bill, I would close the public hearing on the House Bill 2492. And we've got a couple of legislators in the room. I think the first one to arrive was Representative Clem. So, and I know his is very short, so let's open a work session on House Bill 2946.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2946, you will recall, is for annexation elections, requires that votes from both the city and the territory to be annexed be counted. You have the -1 amendment, which changes the applicability from territories of 20 acres and more to territories of 100 acres and more. We are awaiting the fiscal on that. Fiscal analysis.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, co-chairs, member of the committee. For the record, Brian Clem, state representative from here in Salem, an unincorporated Marion County just outside of Salem. I just wanted to explain these new amendments briefly. This models the Washington law closely. It's actually not quite as strict as the Washington law. Washington law appears to not allow any island annexations at all over 100 acres, from what I can read of it. This proposal takes the conditions at which a city would annex people over 100 acres under the amendment from a single majority where the voters in both the county and the city vote in one pool and whoever wins, wins, to a double majority where the area to be annexed and the city each need to approve the annexation. Now, this is one of 13 different annexation methods. There are many other ones that are appropriate for cities to use. The island method is all that we're talking about here. And the public policy question for us is, with this particular method, what is the size of an island? For this method of law that was designed to catch little spots on a map, what is the maximum size before this becomes an abusive way to annex thousands and thousands of people instead of one of the other methods, which are completely appropriate, like they're on city water and sewer, so they have to sign a non-remonstrance agreements that they won't fight annexation. A majority of them want to be annexed, triple majority annexation. This is a method where you don't get a choice, really, in whether you're going to get annexed or not prior to 07. You just get put on the ballot or, in some cities, voted on by city council, and then you're annexed. And in many cases, it's appropriate to not have the person in the two- or three-house island get to overrule the rest of the city because the fact that they're in the island is causing a problem to service providers to have to drive all the way through the city to two people who are, quote, still in the county because they're in this little island. No beef with that. The question is, what is the maximum size for which it begins to become inappropriate to call them an island when they, in some cases, like in my district, are 5,000 people in an island. That's larger than many, many, many cities in Oregon. So I've upped it in the original bill. It was 20 acres. Apparently the city of Salem talked about some upcoming annexations. This would be higher than the threshold for anything they have on the radar screen in Salem. And in Washington, you cannot use the island method over 100 acres at all. I'm not even advocating that. I'm just saying get the people in the island to vote for your proposal if you're going to use the island method. Honestly, the most appropriate method all cities should be using for large amounts of people is what Bend did. It's called the annexation plan method. You lay out a plan. Here's what you're going to get if you get annexed, and then the people vote, and they get streets and sidewalks and sewers and things like that. And if they aren't going to get anything for being annexed, they vote no. If they're going to get something for being now part of their new city and having their taxes raised, then they vote yes. That's the most appropriate method. The island is for narrow circumstances. It was at one point attempted to be used to annex the entire Nike campus. That caused the legislature to act and protect Nike. I'm asking that we do it for normal people, too, not just Nike, because they are shielded from annexation by island method. No one else is currently, unless they can win the support of the city residents, that they are being somehow abused by the city. Now, I just for posterity, I know the Councillor Chuck Bennett, who many of you know, came in and said, I believe that this will not happen. This particular thing I'm talking about in Salem will not happen, maybe in my or his lifetime, I'm not sure which, or our daughter's, I think, too. I wasn't here. The reason this has been such a hot issue is our former mayor, who's no longer mayor, came to this legislature in 05 and announced to a committee that she was going to attempt to island annex the entire area I've discussed within the next 3 years. So that's why everybody was all up in arms. It may be very well that the new council totally changed directions, but that varies every 2 years by election, and it was stated as a stated goal of our council. Our entire council had the goal of annexing everybody in the UGB. So that's why I'm more alarmed than would normally seem appropriate over such an issue.
Questions for Representative Clem about his amendments? Representative Holby.
Thank you. Representative Clem, does this amendment and bill now just address Salem? Or is it statewide?
Any city that wants to use island annexation statewide would be able to do it at 100 acres or more. They just would need to earn the approval of the island residents and the city residents.
Does it have any impact on the annexation being attempted in Lincoln City?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is an annexation using essentially the non-remonstrance agreements, which is a whole different style of annexation. And as a matter of fact, many cities don't actually require a vote on the island annexation method. Only some cities have it in their charters to do that. So it wouldn't even necessarily apply to other cities if they don't vote on it. We in Salem do vote on it. That's why whether you do it by single majority or double majority is a question. Quite a few cities don't vote on it at all. The council votes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clem, now that you've jumped to with your amendment to 100 acres, do you have any history at all of how many cities in the past, have actually annexed that's been over 100 acres?
Chair, I don't, outside of Salem. I know there have been a few proposed around this area that were over 100 acres, but not many. There very few large ones are. And usually if they are, the developer wants them annexed, so they don't use the island method. They use what's called triple majority, where that's a majority of the property owners if it's a voluntary annexation and the people want to be annexed, it's not that hard to get them annexed. It's when people really don't want to be that the island method has been used to date in this area.
Thank you. Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we will await your amendment and the fiscal on that and carry this item over till next Wednesday. So you can push on getting that amendment back in the fiscal by Wednesday. That'd be great. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2946. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3608. Invite forward Representative Fulvey and Representative Dembro. Mr. Sambridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3608 establishes a state apprenticeship education and training fund for the purpose of funding state apprenticeship and training council grants to provide career technical education programs for construction and manufacturing occupations, as well as monitoring those apprenticeship occupations. You have the -1 amendment, which changes the payment amount. The original was $500 for every $1 million of public improvement contract. This would change it to $350 for every $1 million of public improvement contract. And it exempts, the amendment also exempts contracts where use of the funds is restricted by the Oregon Constitution or by federal law.
Proceed in whichever order you'd prefer.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Michael Dembro, state representative for House District 45. That's Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And I'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to present to you House Bill 3608, now with the -1 amendments. This is an important element in a larger effort to create opportunity and success for young Oregonians while creating the skilled workforce that Oregon business and industry needs as we come out of this very difficult recession. Like all of you, I've knocked on thousands of doors during my campaigns and in the interim. Whenever I talk with voters about my background and interest in education, what I hear time after time is the question, why aren't the schools offering vocational education anymore? Why aren't students getting real-world career training? Why are they letting students who could be on a real path to success and decent-paying jobs be allowed to slip through the cracks and drop out? When I would meet with industry and labor groups, I'd hear the same thing over and over. Why isn't the state investing in vocational education and worker training to give young people the skills and a path to replace the skilled workers who will soon be leaving the workforce? These are the workers who are going to help Oregon attract and create the businesses of tomorrow. Many of us heard that message, and working with Labor Commissioner Avakian, we crafted House Bill 3362, the Omnibus Career Technical Education Collaboration Bill, calling for a recommitment to CTE and a new partnership between school districts, community colleges, local business and industry, labor unions, and other community groups to create and support regional technical centers of excellence, pre-apprenticeship programs, and other professional technical programs around the state through public-private funding sources. That bill sends a strong signal to the Oregon Department of Education and to local school districts that legislators want to see career and technical education become a priority again in the state of Oregon. 60 legislators have signed on to that bill, 8 as chief sponsors and 52 as co-sponsors. That's two-thirds of the representatives and senators, which, as you know, is an extremely strong and rare show of support. That bill passed unanimously from the House Education Committee and is now in Ways and Means, where we're hoping to find the necessary general fund dollars to help leverage a number of exciting partnerships. We're going to need more help, though, and that's where House Bill 3608 comes in. House Bill 3608 establishes the State Apprenticeship Education and Training Fund to create additional support for this important effort. The State Apprenticeship Education and Training Fund would be financed through payments of $350 per $1 million of public contracts entered into by contracting agencies at the time the award is made. Money from the fund would be used to make grants for career technical education relating to construction and manufacturing industry skills. Grants from this fund could be used for apprenticeship education and training programs, direct entry, pre-apprenticeship, and youth apprenticeship programs. They could also be used in public school districts, post-secondary educational institutions, and charter schools such as the ACE Academy, a fantastic example of collaboration in East Portland, where 4 school districts have come together to sponsor a charter school and where classes are held in a facility donated by the Carpenters Union with support from the Northwest Construction College and a number of industry partners. Colleagues, construction and manufacturing jobs are at the heart of Oregon's economy, providing family wages and making up nearly 20% of Oregon's non-farm employment with more than 230,000 jobs. To make sure Oregon remains competitive in today's global economy, we must invest in apprenticeship and workforce training programs. House Bill 3608 is one way to do that. Colleagues, I hope you'll join me in supporting this bill. Now, Representative Holvey can explain the Dash 1 amendments and give you any more details about the bill. I'm happy to answer your questions after that.
Welcome to the Rules Committee, Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, and members of the committee. Pleasure to be here before you today. I don't know I have a lot to say because I think Representative Dimbros did such a thorough job of most of the points. There's probably a couple things I could add, but not many. I'll just take you back a couple of years, perhaps, and Representative Dimbro and I sat on the Workforce Development Committee. You know, we looked at a lot of issues trying to figure out how to get VOC-Ed back into our systems. And we came up with the Career Readiness Certificate way back then, and, you know, it's now up and running and doing a great job. And we also looked at the ACE Academy as something of a model and trying to figure out, you know, what a great model this was of actually providing an opportunity for some kids to get some actual vocational education in the schools. And this bill is really aimed at doing a very small step towards that direction. And it, I think it is something that's extremely needed, though we're in this recession right now, and demographics would probably tell you there's a lot of people in the construction industry looking for work, so why do we need to train people? We're going to come out of this recession, and before we went into this recession, we were projecting some major shortfalls in the industry for the skilled workers. And as we come out of this recession, we're going to really get slammed. It'll be the perfect storm, so to speak. And so we're really looking at a way, this bill is really not so much about helping apprenticeship programs as it is about getting kids before they get into apprenticeship programs, trying to get some vocational opportunities back into high schools, back into charter schools, and helping out some of those pre-apprenticeship programs to provide kids with some of the skills that they would need to be successful in programs like this, and plus just to make them aware of those opportunities. The part of the bill, this bill does ask for a very small amount of money out of public contracts. It's not coming out of anybody's operational funds or general funds. It's coming out of public contracts, just as a permit fee or the current prevailing wage enforcement fund, very similar to that. So it's aimed at a different revenue source, and $350 per million. We started out with $500 per million and got a little pushback that that might be a little bit rich. We're still waiting to get a final number on how much money this will actually bring in. The estimates that I've got right now are someplace between about $400,000 and $500,000. It could be as high as $1 million, though. I'm still waiting to see how much. Of course, that's going to fluctuate on the amount of contracts that are out there. So, but that's what it's sort of looking at. And I did exclude, of course, ODOT projects. Pretty hard to take gas tax money and put it into a fund like this. And so we have a provision that makes sure that we're not tapping funds that would be unconstitutional for us to tap or that are some other way restricted for use. And so we tried to address that in the Dash 1 amendments. I'll probably wrap it up with that. I think this is a great opportunity. We hear from industry, from folks all around this state saying, what are we going to do about voc-ed? There's a lot of jobs out there that aren't being filled. Our workforce is getting old, and we need to figure out how to replace that workforce. And quite frankly, since voc-ed has gone out of our public school system, people just aren't aware of the jobs that are out there, and there's a lot of good jobs potentially out there. And this is a small step forward, and I think it's something that we could be proud of, and it's time that somehow we step up and make a small commitment to getting voc-ed back in a light where we have exposure to students. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions, too.
Thank you both. Questions for Representatives Zembro or Holby? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I may have missed it, and they may have said, do you have an idea what this kind of a bill would raise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we're still waiting for some figures on that. We've looked at some of the amount of money that prevailing wage enforcement brings in, and I think Boley will come up and testify to that, and it's going to be substantially less than that since we're not going to be tapping ODOT projects essentially for this fund. So I believe it's going to be around $400,000 to $500,000 a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More than I thought.
Seeing no other questions, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have three other witnesses on this bill, Brian, Bob, and Kate. Please come forward. What a dynamic-looking team. Please proceed in whatever order you'd like.
All right. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3608. As you all know, it's an issue that's near and dear to our hearts at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and increasing our workforce investment dollars and the availability of career technical education for our middle and high schoolers. Commissioner Avakian and Boley definitely support this legislation and the creation of a new fund to provide dollars to this critical workforce training efforts. Apologize, but I'm going to repeat a lot of the same, I think, points that were made by Representative Dembrow and Representative Holvey in it. But in the last 20 years, we have made it harder for our companies to find their workforce here. And at the same time, we've made it harder for our young people to find a pathway to a good family wage job. We laudably push college, but then we make it way too expensive for many to reach. And at the same time, we've virtually eliminated our shop classes or any career technical education from our middle and our high schools. And with the loss of this career education, young people who used to be ready to work at 19 now wander their way into an apprenticeship or community college program when they're 25 to 30. So toward that end, we think that an investment in the career technical education and the type of fund and grants that this bill proposes are absolutely what we need to see in Oregon. And I think that this is both good for our workforce, it's good for our economy, and good to getting those students prepared with the skills that they need for the high wage and high demand jobs of the future. To the question that Representative Barnhart asked about how much this fund would raise, we have not actually had the opportunity to do numbers on the Dash 1 amendments, but when we looked at this bill in 2009, and I know contracting dollars have changed a little bit, but I think we expect it to be about similar and coming back up. When we looked at this bill in 2009, we anticipated that it would raise about $1.6 million each year. And I know now that we're looking at a slightly lesser amount and not applying it to the ODOT projects that it would be a little bit less than that, but I think Representative Holvey was correct in sort of the right ballpark, although I apologize, I don't have an exact number to give you today on that. But it is something that we are working fast and furious on to get for you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Brian, welcome.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, for the record, Brian Krieg, today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, the sheet metal workers of Local 16, and the electricians who are members of the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. We're all three of those groups are supporters of and sponsors of the ACE Academy and are very involved in it. Many of you have heard me talk about the need for CTE and other committees, and I'm not going to go on for a real length of time. I think everyone before me has really hit a lot of the points. One last one, though, that I would like to put in, and I'd say we're very supportive of this bill, make no doubt about that. Public contracting over the last decade, but definitely, you know, over the more recent years, there's been a big push on the building construction industry to expand the amount of folks in the minority communities who are employed by us and starting their own companies in those areas. And I have to say, the loss of shop classes for the last decade has gone the opposite direction for allowing us access to those young folks to expose them to these careers. It's cut them off from seeing the opportunities that they might have in front of them in these industries. And so it's a situation where we have two policies kind of going the opposite directions at the moment of no shop classes, yet wanting those same kids to be involved. And we want them in our industry. And so getting shop classes back, things like the ACE Academy or other models that are out there, new experiments in it, are really important to the future and reaching those goals of more diversity within our workforce. So do urge you to pass this measure. Thank you.
Great. Welcome, Bob.
Chairman, close enough? There we go. Chairman Hunt, Chairman Olson, members of the committee. My name is Bob Calwhite. I am the Assistant Director at the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute, and I'm with the ACE Academy every day. They are housed in our facility as their mainstay of where their classrooms are, and I see the struggles that they have in trying to raise funds into financing in there. Again, I can touch on it, what everybody else has, vocational ed out of all the schools. I think probably look around most of the representatives, and we probably had shop class when we were in school. And if you look at that, the training, as she touched on, older apprentices, they just don't have that whereabouts of what to do when they get out of school if they're not going on to, you know, college or something to that effect. I was around the industry my whole life. My father was a tradesperson. I personally have been in the carpenters for 31 years. And that set of having vocational ed in my school, in high school, was very instrumental in me making a decision on what I was going to do. But this bill has a chance to take programs like ACE and give them an opportunity to help with our funding. It would be great if every one of you could see what these students do. My shop class was nothing what these ACE students do. It's remarkable of what they do and how much they're growing. I've sat through some of their projects that they have done, and just taking their education with their math, their science, and English and putting it into a project and building is remarkable. So we are definitely, the Carpenters are for this bill. We need to get this back. It's been too long, way too long. So definitely, hopefully, that you will proceed with this. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for these three? Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. You're very clear. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? You don't have to. I'm just asking. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Joe Esmond. I'm a business agent for the IBW Local 48, Portland, Oregon, Southwest Washington, representing about 3,600 members. We are 100% in support of this. Again, I just want to echo that exposing these kids, young people, to working with their hands is a good thing. Some will go to college, some won't. Unfortunately, for many years, we've talked with school boards and the superintendent of instruction and say, you need to put these shop classes back in because not everybody's going to go to college. And that's just the way it is at this point. So it's a very good thing. We are founding parts of the ACE Academy. Most of the business managers in the trade unions have come through shop classes, and it seems like a very small impact to the budget. There's a job going. It's going to start in about 2 months, I hope, down on South Waterfront. They are looking for 37% MWESP apprentices. So we got to expose these people. We really have to do it. Some will maybe become engineers one day. I just read an article in the New York Times, that liberal rag, that they are doing this in grade schools back on the East Coast, that kids learn better when they can mess with their hands. I won't take any questions. I'll take questions. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Any questions for Mr. Esmond? No. Thanks, Joe. Seeing no other witnesses on...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
I'd just like to add one thing for the record. I know there was... some concern that, and one thing we didn't really elaborate, that the Apprenticeship Council would be directing these funds, and the Apprenticeship Council, for the record, is made up of industry and labor, and to direct these funds and where they might make grants to specific schools, to help out some of these programs or to start some of these programs. These programs that this bill is designed to help are at the high school level, so they are not union or non-union specific. They help the whole industry. And I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And this bill, as I think Mr. Stambridge noted earlier, does have a subsequent referral for Ways and Means, two Ways and Means. So hopefully we can get this queued up for a work session. Expeditiously close the public hearing on House Bill 3608. Colleagues, the other two bills we have, we're going to ask Mr. Stembridge, actually Representative Holby can bring us up to speed on one, Mr. Stembridge on the other. We are awaiting fiscals on both. Both have amendments to them. We have fallen probably justifiably to the back of the line in terms of the fiscal statements because the other policy committees are up against deadlines to move bills by the 20th. And so those other bills are being prioritized. So we're not going to move these other two bills, but... why don't we start with House Bill 3576, and should I open a work session in order to discuss this, or open a work session on House Bill 3576?
Mr. Chairman, I can summarize it if
Please.
You'd like. It's House Bill 3576. It's for determining the required habitation within a district required for serving as a state representative or senator. It directs the Secretary of State to consider the district in which the candidate is registered to vote. You have the -1 amendment, which I believe Representative Holby can speak to, or you'd like me to.
Please, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, State Representative Paul Holby, for the record. The -1 amendment was a collaboration between Legislative Council and the Secretary of State's Division looking for some way to basically put into the record that we should consider the items listed A through G in subsection 1 of section 1 of this amendment. I guess that's about as close as we could get to laying out some criteria for what an inhabitant is according to Section 8, Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution. That's about the best of my knowledge of it. I don't know if I would like the Secretary of State to comment whether this bill has any value to him.
We're in a work session. So does anyone have any questions about this Dash 1 amendment? Again, we're waiting for the fiscal, so we're not going to move it today, but this is just to make sure we're all on the same page, so when we get the fiscal back, we're ready to roll. Representative Barnhart, you want to move your mic over toward you, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My recollection may be wrong, bad at this time of the afternoon, but it seems to me that in order for a candidate to run at all, they have to be registered to vote. Have I forgotten something about that? It seems to me that in order to run at all, you have to be registered to vote, and if you want to run in a party, in a major party at least, you have to be registered as a member of that party, with some exceptions, obviously.
I think you had to have been there for like a year or two.
So therefore, go on with this.
Therefore, 18, line 18 is redundant.
I don't think that's referencing the whether or not they are registered. I think that's referencing the location of
the
registration. Am I reading that correctly, Representative Holby?
Mr. Chair, if I could defer to legislative counsel on this, thank you.
Representative Holby, in a rare move of wisdom, defers to legislative counsel.
My name is Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council. Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, it's actually not a requirement in the Constitution to be registered to vote to be a candidate for state senator or state representative.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which seems surprising to you guys right now.
You don't...
If you lose by one vote, you'd be very angry.
So the requirements are not that you've been registered to vote for a year prior to the election, it's that you've been a resident of the district for a year prior to the election. Is that right?
Representative Hunt, that's true. There's an inhabitancy. You have to be an inhabitant of your district for a period of time.
So if I could follow up on that, the only restrictions that the legislature is allowed to put are the ones that are in the Constitution, yes, or can we add other requirements?
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. That's the limitations I think Representative Holby's referred to in other hearings. You know, because the Constitution sets out the criteria for being qualified to be a representative or a senator, we can neither... add to or subtract from that by statute.
So if I could follow up. So the point of this bill then would be to give you guidance to figure out where the person is actually an inhabitant using the constitutional language.
Representative Barnhart, that's right. I think right now the Constitution is the only place that uses the word inhabitant in our statutes. We use residency for purposes of registering to vote, but I think as Representative Holby's figured out, those are different things.
Okay.
And yes, so the bill, I think, attempts to give the Secretary of State some concrete guidance how to determine inhabitancy for purposes of candidacy for office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this helps clarify for me this amendment quite a bit.
Please, Gina. Representative Berger.
Well, I was just going to comment. Gina, does the Constitution mention registering to vote at all? I mean, was it even an issue when the Constitution was written? You were a resident and you voted. So I think that it wasn't an oversight. It just hadn't been thought of yet. Somebody thought of it later.
Representative Berger, that may be true, that the Constitution also sets forth... it sets forth what sort of minimum qualifications to be an elector.
Right.
But, yeah.
Registering was not on that list. Thank you. We didn't have the bureaucracy around it at the time. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Holby, in terms of kind of public clarity about what version we're considering, especially based on the other bill we took up today. Do you want to move the Dash 1s so that becomes the bill, and then we'll just leave that pending a work session next week until we get the fiscal? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3576, dated 4-6-2011.
Representative Holdman moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3576. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I know we're kind of running late, but I would like to hear from the Secretary of State's office on just their viewpoint of this bill and whether it's going to be helpful in identifying in people that are actually eligible to run for office or to take office in the future.
Steve, you were feeling left out today anyway, so go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director, I was feeling left out. This bill will help us. As has been previously discussed, inhabitancy is what the Constitution requires. Most of what is talked about in the statutes is residency. They aren't necessarily the same thing. And we talked about some examples the last time we talked about this, but I think the value of this bill is it gives us, this list of five or six different things that we can consider in determining inhabitancy, and makes it as similar as we can to residency without crossing the line and having any constitutional issues. And so Gina and I worked on this one to try and make sure that we could give the Elections Division as much guidance and direction as possible without running afoul of any constitutional limitations. So I think this, this helps. It's not the cure-all, but, when there's constitutional provisions involved, that oftentimes limits what we can and can't do.
That answers your question, Representative Holby?
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions on this amendment that's before us?
Senator Berger says the cure-all bills are in Revenue Committee.
Is there objection to adopting the dash one amendments? Seeing none, we've adopted the dash one amendments, and we will wait on the fiscal statement and move this over. Mr. Co-Chair, is it okay to move this one over to Mr. Co-Chair, okay to move this one over to next Wednesday?
Affirmative.
As well, we will move this House Bill 3576 over to our next Wednesday agenda. Close the work session
20th of April.
Thank you. April 20th, and close the work session on House Bill 3576, and last but not least, open a work session on House Bill 3148.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3148, you may recall this one, for signatures required for including materials in the voter's pamphlet. This is the alternative to paying the fee. It requires state senator and state representative signatures to be those of active electors in the candidate's electoral district. And you have the dash 5 amendment, which has arrived very recently. It sets the number of signatures required at 400 for state senator and 200 for state representative. It defines active elector, and it deletes the proposed restrictions on signatures to be submitted by a political party or assembly.
This is again a situation where we are awaiting the fiscal. Anyone have questions for Mr. Stembridge or questions of
Mr. Chair? I understand, having talked with Representative Cannon, that there actually is possibly one more set of amendments that he's considering. So I'm just wondering if we could just hold off on doing any action here.
Yep. Any other questions at this point? Seeing none, we will move this item also over to that same agenda on Wednesday, April 20th, and close the work session on House Bill 3148. Seeing no other business before us, we are adjourned.